Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
People who do like getting out of bed this morning probably are some of the England footballers, at least. I hope that despite all the racism that was going on, coming in from the crowd and the investigation that UEFA are starting today, I hope that they will wake up and think, you know what? Whatever went on in the stands, whatever people shouted at us, we've played two very good games of football over the last 4 days and proved that we're a young side in years, but an older side in terms of ability. If you've read anything or watched anything of the England game, whether it was live or afterwards, you'll know exactly what state the country was in the last time, you know, when Callum Hudson-Odoi was born, who the England manager was, who was number one in the charts, prime minister. It's the kind of thing that you always roll out, don't you? Kevin Keegan, I think, resigned in a loo the day after Callum Hudson-Odoi was born. But it doesn't really matter. What does matter is that he has started to make his mark on the international footballing stage. And I want to talk about the football, because much as the racism row has overshadowed the performance today, it's important that we don't forget that Callum Hudson-Odoi made his full England debut last night, first start for England. And it's really important, as far as I'm concerned, but crucially as far as he's concerned, that he remembers last night for all the right reasons, not the wrong ones. He, like the rest of England's non-white players, was subjected to a tirade of racist abuse that was frankly sadly predictable. So let's talk about the football. We'll talk about the racism later, but I do want to talk about the football. Hudson-Odoi, of course, was given the start. Sancho, who I think was struggling with a little bit of fatigue more than anything else, on the bench. Hudson-Odoi started on the right wing. Realistically, his best position is on the left. Obviously, at Chelsea, Eden Hazard occupies that berth. For England, it's Raheem Sterling who ends up on the left. So, say what you like about Callum Hudson, you can fault his timing. Probably should have picked a different era, a different set of teams to come. Maybe if he'd been Scottish and played for, say, Manchester United, he'd get a little bit more of a game. But, you know, he wants to be the best. He's got to beat the best. This time, Sterling was preferred on the left, and Hudson-Odoi, I think you can see, struggled a little on the right. He wasn't by any means as effective as we believe he can be when he played on the right. But arise Gareth Southgate. Credit to a flexible manager who understands his players. And Raheem Sterling has played on the right very well. I've seen it happen multiple times for City that he has played on the right-hand side and been very, very effective. He switched them round. Callum Hudson-Odoi went and played on the left, and it made a massive difference. And of course, we saw him have his biggest impact as an England player so far. Cut in from the left, hit that shot, which probably was going a little wide, and Ross Barkley rather helpfully just squeezed it past the goalkeeper. It's a great way for Hudson-Odoi to announce himself a little bit on the international stage. But he wasn't perfect. I don't want to criticise him, but there's a reason that he doesn't start for Chelsea. A, he's only 18. Very young guy. Don't forget, 18 is very young, both in footballing, physical and in emotional years. You have a lot to deal with at that stage, and there is such a thing as much too young, and I wouldn't want to give him that. Maurizio Sarri at Chelsea has always refused, famously almost, to give him a Premier League start, but he has at least always been clear why. He says his work without the ball has not been good enough, and sadly, before he was able to have that impact on the left wing, setting up that goal for Ross Barkley, he also showed the other side, that the Mr. Hyde, if you will, of his performances, which was that 17 minutes in, he tried to run back and cover Zarko Tomasevic, who outjumped him. Frankly, Hudson-Odoi didn't even jump, which I thought was poor. And then when the ball was knocked down, Michael Keane slightly beaten in the air, Hudson-Odoi wasn't alert to the danger of the knockdown. He wasn't on his balls of his feet. He was flat-footed. And Marko Vasevic nipped in. And Hudson-Odoi knew he was out of position here because he panicked and tried to sprint to get back in behind, but the damage was already done. All right, Michael Keane should have done better as well. But that's a kind of example of the weakness in Callum Hudson-Odoi's game. He will get better. And it didn't cost England overall, realistically. But I'm sure that Hudson-Odoi will know that is something that he needs to work on. He knows that if he does want to continue to feature at the very top level of professional football, He needs to contribute both with and without the ball. You can't just be an attacking player. It's not enough in modern football anymore. You look at someone like Dimitar Berbatov. I don't know if he would have got away with being the player that he was these days. Sure, he was a fabulous attacker and didn't always need to run everywhere, but you have to work without the ball. It's why Liverpool are so successful. It's why City are so successful. Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid even sometimes. It's because they work hard without the ball. I tell you, every time I've seen Barcelona in the flesh 4 or 5 times, and every single time I watch them, I have the same revelation. And I don't know why I don't just remember it and stop revealing it to myself. It's that the wingers, whether it's Neymar, Suarez, Messi, those attacking players almost work harder without the ball than they do with it. When Barca don't have the ball, they are furiously chasing it down. And that's very intimidating to play against. So while Hudson-Odoi will continue to intimidate people when he's got the ball, and you saw it when he cut in the first half, defenders didn't want to go near him, never mind try and tackle him. But he does have to try and intimidate them when they've got the ball as well. I know there wasn't a lot of opportunity for that last night. Montenegro had 30% possession. But still, Hudson-Odoi found himself caught out. That said, he's young. He'll learn. And he does seem like an old head on young shoulders. I was very impressed with how he spoke afterwards. And actually, that's true of the whole England team, really, the old headness of them. Southgate warned them it would be a hostile atmosphere. Actually, there were quite a few empty seats, so in the end, it probably wasn't as loud as it might have been. Nevertheless, it was vociferous from those who were there. Southgate even talked about the possibility of some racism, of a racist incident. He'll also have mentioned the Wayne Rooney red card back in 2011 and the ramifications that had for Euro 2012 when he missed the first two games and he wasn't really himself. They did go behind, and we've seen England teams go behind in weird places in Europe before, and it doesn't end well. But this lot didn't panic. Rudyard Kipling's poem If is quoted far too much in sport, but this really was a case of keeping their heads when all around were losing theirs, whether it was in the crowd, whether it was panics even within the team. And there was the odd moment when people looked panicked, but they stuck by the football they knew would get them over the line, that saw off the checks, that got them to a World Cup semi-final. And indeed, it did get them over the line. Ross Barkley shone. Dele Alli, I thought, played even well. Even though he didn't seem to contribute on the score sheet, he interchanged well with Harry Kane. Ross Barkley, as I said, is starting to grow into himself, to work out what sort of player he needs to be, both at England and eventually at Chelsea. Jordan Pickford, even. Didn't have a lot to do, but a couple of tricky moments which he dealt with pretty well. And he was relatively well protected as well. Harry Kane looked lively, enjoying the fact that he's not the only attacker defences had to worry about. This is still a young England team, but I think we learnt a lot last night about what they can achieve, because it was a moment that was going to test their character and they came through with flying colours.
Love Sport.
England's 4-3-3 ripped Montenegro apart last night, I thought, and they did a similar thing to the Czech Republic. It's the first time in 10 years they've scored more than 4 in 2 consecutive games. They're on absolute fire under Gareth Southgate. They're a pleasure to watch. They've got an exciting young team and they're scoring goals seemingly for fun. The midfield looks settled, even when we had a number of changes last night with Barkley, Alli and Declan Rice starting, where, say, Henderson and Eric Dier had previously, they still look relatively settled. It was impressive. Their fullbacks are playing well. Danny Rose is not necessarily England's first choice left back. He's in the conversation, but there's plenty of depth. And I think that's maybe what's most exciting about England at the moment, is they do seem to have quite a lot of depth in various different positions. Even look, Jadon Sancho, who is perhaps, I think, top of the assist table in Europe at the moment, alongside Lionel Messi, whoever he is. And essentially, he was benched because he was a little bit tired. And England did not look any the worse. But is this down to a tactical switch more than anything else? Let's talk to someone who knows much more than me about this. It's JJ Bull, a tactics expert and a writer for The Telegraph as well. JJ, is this a tactical masterstroke from Gareth Southgate, or was 4-3-3 the obvious way that he eventually had to go?
I think he had to change something from the World Cup system, which is very rigid. You know, they want to make sure that they weren't getting beaten first. And then they won, well, he got to the semi-final mostly on corner kicks and penalties. But I think
they still count, JJ. There's nothing illegal about penalties and corner kicks.
If Scotland could get any goals from anything, it would be fine.
Oh, tell me about it. Let's not talk about Scotland. It's too depressing.
Okay, well, I think Southgate's natural progression had to be going to something more more attacking, more entertaining. They've got lots of really good attacking players, lots of creativity and lots of pace. And you tend to find the best teams, I think, in world football usually play a 4-3-3. International football, a lot of teams play a 4-2-3-1, which gives you a bit more security. But it relies on you being good in transition rather than breaking down teams. And because England are normally the team that gets to dominate possession, it makes sense having a 4-3-3 because you've got all these attacking players who can then get their passes together and do something pretty in the final third, as opposed to sitting back and just grinding out those 1-0 wins that you had under Capello or people like that.
Now, Ross Barkley obviously got himself on the score sheet twice last night. He was played, by all accounts, as well as he has in an England shirt. Do you think he is the perfect man for that long-term role as a midfielder who can break into the box?
I'm not sure. I think he's very good at that. I think he's good at running from deep, and he's very good on the ball, and he's got fantastic control, and he makes things happen. But I still feel like he gives away the ball far too much. And I think you'll find that players like, for example, Luka Modric, you can fire the ball to him under any circumstance, any game, Champions League final, World Cup final, anything, and it will stick to his foot, and he'll be fine, and he'll make the right decision every time. I still think Barkley he makes the wrong decision sometimes, and maybe when he has to think about things too much, that's when things go awry. Like, he's naturally, everything he does makes sense, and he's a great player. But I think at the absolute top level, he doesn't make the right decisions too often, and is let down sometimes by his decision. Yeah, his passing often lets him down.
So for you, and maybe given that you're Scottish, you can have a dispassionate view of this, because a lot of England fans basically seem to hate Eric Dier or Jordan Henderson or both. For you, do they both feature in your first choice England three-man midfield?
I think, well, for that, the way Southgate set that 4-3-3 up, you need one of the midfielders, the six, the holding player, to not do anything too fancy. They need to just sit in between midfield and defence, get the ball and play it short to the side or something like that. And Dyer is very good at doing that, and he also plays in defence, so he gives you tactical fluidity that you can drop into it. Henderson, I think, is another one of these kind of, again, a very good player, great mentality, what you need on the pitch, kind of leader. But again, when there's a pressure situation, his game tends to crumble a little bit. You saw it in the semi-final when he played for England before, in the World Cup, when he was pinging balls to no one, his passing just goes all wrong. And you can't have that. You need players who can keep their game together at that top level. I think you have to have one of them in there. I think Declan Rice did very well when he played in that kind of holding role. He came on forget who they beat the other day.
Czech Republic, yeah.
That's the one, Czech Republic, yeah. He's very good at that. And he's done that for West Ham all season. But he's very neat and tidy, whereas you have certain players that will play in that role over in history. I can think of the best example is someone like Busquets for Spain, or Andrea Pirlo, something like that. Players who can not only take the ball under pressure and turn, but they're never really flustered, and they are able to find either a long or short pass very, very easily under any circumstance. Whereas, like I say, I think Henderson is a great player, but when it's high-pressure situations, things just go wrong.
Right. So is there anyone, because I don't think, unless you could name someone, I don't think England have that player fully formed yet. Is there anyone who can play in the Henderson role who might come through from this great raft of golden generation players plus one that we seem to have?
That's a difficult question. I'm trying to think just now, top of my head. I know Lewis Cook at Bournemouth, right. Really highly rated. He did very well in the under-21s as well, under Southgate, actually. And he is a player who is able to do that and has been brought through with that kind of England DNA,
right,
malarkey, where you've got that thing going on. And apart from that, I can't think of anyone right now off the top of my head. But as soon as I hang up this phone call, I know I'm going to have about five.
Yeah, I'm sure. Don't worry. I'm sure people will be tweeting in with various suggestions for that role. But up front as well, I was reading a bit of Danny Higginbotham today, an interesting sort of analysis from him, saying that Kane's unselfish strikerhood is so key to that system. Can you explain what that striker needs to be and what Harry Kane is?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Kane is an out-and-out number nine, and he gets in the box at the right times. He takes shots early. He takes a lot of more shots and a lot of players in a similar position. But he's very, very aware of those around him and what he brings to the team as opposed to what the team does for him. And you see, especially with Raheem Sterling, so although they're kind of a force of faith for a lot of it, you often find Sterling is up top alongside him, and Kane will drop into the 10 space just behind it, which allows Sterling to run in behind because he's faster. So defenders are drawn out. When Kane drops, the centre-back's normally tight to him because it's Harry Kane. You don't let him go. But as he drops, that centre-back follows, which frees up space in behind for someone like Sterling to bomb in behind, and that gives you a ball over the top, and he's straight through. And again, that was something they did very well during the World Cup. And it seems to be a strategy that Southgate wants to bring into the team he's got now, and they absolutely can the way they've done it. He's a great player, Kane.
JJ, it's a pleasure speaking to you. I could go on all day. That's JJ Bull, writer for Telegraph Football and also a tactical expert. Interesting to hear what England can do and also that kind of England DNA. Lewis Cook's an interesting one. Haven't heard a lot about him recently, but maybe he's the man to replace Jordan Henderson, although, frankly, I quite like little Jordan.
This is Love Sport.
It may be late March, it may only be about 12 degrees, but the sun is shining, and that means that early season County Championship cricket is underway, but also out in India, the IPL, and England doing their best to send some representatives and play very well. Joss Butler making a magnificent 69, and then Ravi Ashwin man-cads him.
Yeah, crazy. I was watching it live here in the studio while we were on air on Drive Time yesterday. You just couldn't really believe your eyes that you were seeing it, not particularly in outrage. It wasn't the first reaction. It was sheer shock, really. And I think that was Butler's reaction too. It has happened to him before. I remember against Sri Lanka playing for England about 4 or 5 years ago.
Just very briefly, for people who don't know what the man cad is, essentially it's when you're trying to steal a little extra yard or two in the from the non-striking end, and they stop bowling and just run you out there and then. The sort of tradition is to warn the batsman once and say, look, you actually went a little bit early there, and next time I'll run you out. Ashwin forwent that.
That's right. That is sort of the tradition, but it's the right word to use because it's not in the rule book. What is in the rule book is you're allowed to do exactly what Ravi Ashwin did. In simple terms, there's some debate and it probably won't ever be settled, certainly not on Twitter, where I don't think anything's ever decided.
Yes, that black hole of debate.
Exactly, about whether or not he was fully into his bowling stride, which I would argue he probably was, because he planted his foot, his arm was just about to load, as he called it, to essentially come over and bowl when he decided to actually stop. I would argue that he has gone far enough there for the batsman to have decided, if he were watching him all the way, that the ball is about to be bowled. And at that exact moment, Joss Butler's bat was in his ground. By the time that Ravi Ashwin, a couple of seconds later, took the bails off, Joss Butler had taken another couple of steps. He was maybe half a yard out of his crease, and he was clearly out in sort of very simple terms. The surprise was probably that he hadn't warned him, yes, but then again, this is a game of 2020. There's not a lot of time in these games. It is obviously at a premium, every ball counts, all that sort of stuff. So he probably thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I want to make it count. Mm-hmm. And he's had a bit of a backlash since. He spoke after the game. He stood by his actions, perhaps unsurprisingly. Ravi Ashwin, who is, of course, captain of that franchise, he said, how can it be unsporting? It's in the rules. If you don't like them, then the rules need to be changed, which is a fair point by and large, because
well,
I think there's a lot of people.
There are no rules in cricket. There are laws. There are laws in cricket, but no rules.
Yeah, you're quite
but
right.
But look, the laws also mention the spirit of the game, and this is the kind of catch-all thing that we come back to so often, the spirit of the game. And is this without of the spirit of the game? Surely it is.
I think it is, but the spirit of the game is a very loose concept, isn't it? I mean, how do you define that? You either, if you want something to be a rule or a law, you put it in the laws. You don't have a set of laws and then sort of tack along at the bottom, oh, and everything should be done in a fair spirit, because that's not how sport at the top level is played. I know cricket likes to think of it. I'm a massive cricket fan, as are you, but we can't pretend that cricket actually lives up to its sort of reputation or self-given reputation of being the ultimate for sportsmanship and gentility
golf,
and all that
sort.
Well, at least they do call their own
fouls.
Well,
this is the famous thing that they used to say, is in football I always cheat, in cricket I sometimes cheat, and in golf I never cheat. And that is supposed to be the adage. And I suppose this is where in cricket, yeah, this spirit of the game, this woolly phrase that just covers basically being a nice bloke. You know, it's like walking for a caught behind, admitting that you hit a ball. It's not within the rules, and there's a huge debate as to whether you should and shouldn't do it. But I would say, for Ravi Ashwin, looking at the reaction of most of the pros, I've seen him called out by Shane Warne, Owen Morgan, Michael Vaughan. These are guys who all competed at the top of the level, most of whom played in the IPL itself, and all know the pressures that these
players
are under.
True. What's interesting, though, is those people you mentioned there, Shane Warne, an ambassador for Butler's team, Rajasthan Royals. Mm. Michael Vaughan, of course, the former England captain. Owen Morgan, Joss Butler's current England captain, the one-day setup. Jofra Archer, interestingly, a Rajasthan Royals and possibly soon-to-be England teammate as well, tweeted and then deleted something along the lines of, how disgraceful, how embarrassing that as the captain of the team, that's what you resort to get the other person out. Quite telling. He did delete it. Perhaps he was told to. We don't know. But my point is that they're all essentially on Butler's side there. I think there are plenty of people, Indians, of course, who are going to bat their man. And I think the point is that had this been the other way round, had it been, say, Butler doing it to an Indian batsman, I don't know. I'd like to think I'd be a little bit disappointed in the actions, but ultimately the law is there. So I do think you've got to be very careful as a batsman, not least Josh Butler, who has been run out doing this in international cricket. Mm. If nearly 5 years later he is still guilty of doing this, whether it's marginal as it arguably was in this case or much more obvious, I think he has a lot to answer for. If he does it for England or if he's guilty of it for England at the World Cup this summer, while it might be disappointing if it's in the laws, it's ultimately up to him to stay within them. And it would be unforgivable for it to happen again. Let's hope that it's better now than in a World Cup semi-final in July.
Well, it's Lady Havisham, isn't it? Once is unfortunate, twice starts to look like carelessness. Three times would, as you say, be unforgivable. Fingers crossed it doesn't happen, because actually Josh Butler is probably the best player in the world at the moment. He's in unbelievable form.
And the biggest shame of all, because Rajasthan Royals, as we were talking about yesterday, have the biggest English contingent of any team in the IPL. We're going very nicely with Butler at the crease. I think they're only one down, possibly two down. And Butler, as you say, 69 not out. I think he'd have led them to victory. They still needed sort of 9 or 10 and over. But with those wickets in hand, with Butler at the crease, you'd have backed them. They had good batting to come. It took the shine, really, this incident away from Steve Smith's return to the IPL. He made 20 before getting out. Ben Stokes came in, hit his first ball for six, got out on the next one. They completely collapsed. They lost 50-odd runs for eight wickets for 50-odd runs. It really sent them into a nosedive from which they never recovered. And, yeah, that was a shame for Rajasthan Royals. A bit of a shame for the IPL that we're maybe talking about cricket for the wrong reasons. But I hope most of all that Josh Butler's learnt his lesson, because, crucially, this law is not about to be changed, whatever you think of it.
Love sport.
And I do want to touch on that Conor McGregor news. I say news with inverted commas there, to be perfectly honest, because he may, as I mentioned, he may actually not yet have retired, but he has at least said he has, from MMA and, of course, from the UFC franchise that launched him into global fame. And to be fair, he has emerged as the most famous name from that particular company. I mean, I just the statement itself, I find slightly baffling. He says the sport formerly, and he says for as in formal, formerly known as mixed martial art today. I wish all my colleagues well going forward in competition. I will now join my former partners on this venture already in retirement. Proper pina coladas on me, fellas. Now, it's pretty jumbled. It was late at night or very, very, very early in the morning in the UK when it came out. I think it was closer to maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night in the US, where McGregor may have been. I think he'd been filming with Jimmy Fallon as it happened. Look, let's have a look at what he's achieved, right? Plenty of career highlights. He became UFC champion in 2015. He then defended it in that massive clash with Jose Aldo. That was probably his most famous victory in some ways. Although he followed it up. Remember, he moved up to welterweight, which I think is still his best weight. Lost to Nate Diaz, came back 5 months later, won the rematch. Don't forget that he's been very active. We criticise boxers. Anthony Joshua is now in a thing where he probably is only going to fight twice a year at best. Conor McGregor got through a decent number of fights in his heyday, which would make sense because you want to make the money while you can, while you're popular. He fought Nate Diaz, he lost, he came back and he beat him on points in Las Vegas. And you have to give him some credit for that. And then he moved weight again. He has been a UFC champion in the featherweight, the welterweight and the lightweight championship. He held the lightweight and the welterweight titles at the same time. No one had ever done that. I know UFC doesn't have a long history. We're getting close to 250 events now. It's got a decent history. And McGregor was the first man ever to hold two different belts at the same time. He went and did professional boxing. All right, it was a circus, but he was still able to sell and achieve that. So there's been a lot of career highlights. He's made a huge amount of money. He's achieved loads in the sport and outside. So who could begrudge him retirement from what is a dangerous sport at the age of 30? Me. That's who. I mean, I can hold a grudge against anyone, but particularly because I have no idea if this is his actual retirement. Let's not forget that McGregor has retired before. Back in 2016, he tweeted that he had, quote, decided to retire young. Thanks for the cheese. Catch yous later. Yet similarly, slightly incomprehensible, but essentially, he was lying. He wasn't retiring. It was, I think, a jibe, a dig at Nate Diaz, who then also sort of faux-retired on Twitter. Look, it's a ploy in combat sports to retire and then come back and to sort of imbue your legend even further. But it's beyond a joke at this point. Honestly, the number of times boxers or combat fighters end up retiring. And I like to think that we can smell the ploy. For example, if you were UFC boss Dana White, I think you'd be pretty miffed that your fattest cash cow was walking away, happily mooing. And yet he said of the news that Conor had retired, quote, "He has the money to retire. His whiskey," he's now promoting a whiskey brand of his own, by the way, "his whiskey is killing it. It totally makes sense. And if I was him, I would retire too. He's retiring from fighting, not from working. The whiskey will keep him busy. He's been so fun to watch." Now, maybe Dana's got a piece of his whiskey. Maybe Dana's got a percentage of Conor McGregor's whiskey. I don't know. But the amount of money he's made out of McGregor, I would be pretty gutted if McGregor had just dropped Mike overnight, because this didn't seem like a planned announcement. He didn't come out and say, you know, with a big two-page statement, something written in notes on his iPhone that he then screen grabs countless times. Dana White wasn't ready to have this sort of a statement come out on his behalf. This seems like a pretty sudden and pretty unexpected announcement from McGregor. And if I were Dana White, I'd be fuming, unless you didn't think it was real. McGregor might make a sensational comeback, I think. And maybe it'll be after a year, maybe it'll be after 2 years. He's 30, still relatively young, he's in decent nick. And that's the problem. Everyone acknowledges the drama and the heroism that sports like boxing, MMA, kickboxing, Thai boxing, all these sports do create a lot of really brilliant drama. But there's so much rush to recreate it. And it sort of often comes in a really staged way, really ugly staged way. And I think that's the problem. Fans love sport because it's the greatest unscripted soap opera in the world. You couldn't make up Liverpool winning the Champions League in Istanbul. You couldn't make... If you wrote that in a film, people would laugh at you because it was so unrealistic. 3-0 down at halftime to AC Milan, scoring three scrappy goals and then winning the penalty shootout. You would just laugh at it. There's absolutely no way you would make that up. Japan beating South Africa in the Rugby World Cup. Johnny Wilkinson kicking drop goals. That disallowed... look, there are so many moments in sport that are truly, utterly dramatic. Even Tyson Fury getting off the canvas almost miraculously against Deontay Wilder, albeit just to get a draw. That is a Hollywood ending that you couldn't make up. But Conor McGregor can make these endings up because he already has. And I think when it's scripted, fans can smell it. I hope that most will recognise this isn't necessarily goodbye for Conor McGregor, because it's probably more like au revoir. It might not actually be deliberate either. It might be that when Conor comes back, and I almost expect that he will, in a year, he says, "Look, I actually did mean to retire, but I feel I've made a mistake." His last fight, remember, in MMA was a defeat to Khabib Nurmagomedov, who's a terrific fighter, and it was a much vaunted fight for the UFC lightweight championship. But I don't think someone like McGregor will want to leave on a defeat. No one ever does. One person who did, actually, is Tony Bellew. He was beaten by Alexander Usyk. But there was a kind of honour in that, because he said, "Look, this is a fight I never even dreamt I could get into, for all the titles." And he wrote an excellent column last week about how hard it is to walk away, and talking about how boxing is rich in sob stories of those who came back for a few quid, but I will not be one of them. Now, McGregor, let's face it, is a pretty rich guy. He's pretty open about that, let's be honest. His Instagram is essentially a walking visual bank account. But these people go bust. Everyone can go bust. If you live a high-octane lifestyle with high costs, you can go bust. And it does happen. I don't necessarily think it will happen with McGregor. He seems to think his whiskey's going very well. But I am always wondering, when you see someone plugging a product hard, doesn't that mean they need the money? Floyd Mayweather, for example, his Instagram is mostly advertising his strip clubs. Every time, "Come down to our club on Friday or Saturday, these girls are on." Doesn't that make you think? Doesn't that make you think Floyd Mayweather might not have as much money as he claims? He still works a lot as a manager. Doesn't that make you think the man who calls himself the money team, doesn't that make you think he might not have quite as much money as he does team? Might be. And Conor McGregor might end up down that route. I'm not saying he will, and I wish him all the best. He's walked away from a dangerous sport healthy. And now that he's a father, I imagine that's even more important than before. But when he comes back, people will say, "You're the boy who cried wolf. You retired twice and then came back because you didn't really mean it. How can we believe anything that you say ever again?" Love Sport. Now, is Danny Mills as excited about the England squad as everyone else? Danny, it's been a great 4 days, 10 goals, 4 days. The racist chanting aside, and let's talk focus on the football for a minute, England have been fabulous lately, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I think in both games they started a little bit slowly, but I think sometimes that can happen. It's a difficult time of the year sometimes for internationals. We've seen an awful lot of pullouts, and I think that's because you've got teams going for title challenges, teams in the Champions League, massive games. So any little niggles, one or two players have pulled out. But I think the youngsters that have come in have done a fantastic job. There's a lot of talk about Jadon Sancho. He got his start. Hudson-Odoi last night. Should he start from the beginning, having not played in the Premier League or not started in the Premier League? But he was magnificent. And I think, you know, that's what Gareth has done. He's given those players that have played at the junior levels at England the opportunity. And you can't really argue with a 5-0 and a 5-1.
Do you think that Hudson-Odoi, Southgate should just say to himself, look, I think he's good enough, I'm just going to start him, and it shouldn't necessarily matter how much he's played at senior level for Chelsea? Or does actually Southgate have to temper that and say, look, mate, you need to get some more experience at club level?
Ultimately, he needs to play regularly, you know, week in, week out, you know, for a team. But you have to remember, he has come on in the Premier League, you know, which a lot of the talk was, well, how can you leave out Jack Grealish and not play him and say, well, it's because he's playing in the Championship? Hudson has come on quite a few times this season and is impressed. He's playing against top quality defenders in the Premier League. He's also played an awful lot in the Europa League, and they're through to the semi-final in that competition. So again, they've seen him at a very high standard. They've seen him at the under-21s. And as a forward player, it's a little bit easier, should I say, because it's a bit more of a luxury. If you have a bad game as a winger or as a forward player, you can get away with it. If you have a bad game as a defender, you're 2-0 down, you know, and you're right up against it. He's got pace, he's got ability, he's been through the system. Gareth and Steve Holland have looked at him for a long, long time. They'll have seen him in training, they know what he's all about, and they thought, you know what, he's exciting, he's got that ability, why not? And this, is it any different from the Rashford situation? When you look at, you know, Rashford's got there, what, 30 caps, I believe. When he first started, he wasn't playing regularly for Manchester United, and he hardly ever started games, but he was still playing very well for England because he's got that quality. The problem for Hudson-Odoi is he's got Eden Hazard, Willian and Pedro in front of him at Chelsea, which makes it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I was thinking that when he started on the right last night as well, with Raheem Sterling starting on the left. He doesn't half pick people to go up against, does he? Sterling and Eden Hazard. It's competition for places, to say the least.
It's brilliant. And that's, sorry, it's fabulous because so many, over the years, there's been a real struggle for English players going forward. Players that can pick the ball up, run at people, can dribble, can go past people with a trick. Now Gareth has got an abundance of forward options. Look at the players that missed out last night. Okay, Harry Kane is pretty much always going to start, you know, down the middle. But then you've got Raheem Sterling, you've got Rashford coming to that. Behind that, you've got the likes of Lallana, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who still aren't fit. All the younger players coming through as well. You know, Sancho, Odoi, Foden, you know, eventually in the next couple of years. All these players. Gareth really does, Dele Alli, you know, he really does have an outstanding group of young forward players. What his hardest job is to find the right system, the right formation, to fit them all in.
We should touch on the crowd stuff that happened last night, Danny, because I think it's right to. But where do we go from here? Because for me, this is how it looks to me, is that basically the FA and UEFA and FIFA, frankly, haven't done enough or haven't sent a clear enough message to these footballing bodies about racism. Is that unfair? Is it a bigger job than that?
I think it's very fair that you say that. You know, what needs to happen is everybody needs to come together and say, right, if there is racist chanting from the crowd, this is the punishment. If there is racist chanting or racist abuse from a player to a player, this is the punishment. And then you know exactly what it is and you know what's going to happen. And that will, in terms of the crowd, and we've seen it a little bit, obviously, Chelsea were accused of things, it then becomes self-policing. Because if people hear it in the concourse or wherever, they'll say, look, lads, if this is heard, you know, by the public or by a player or by a steward or whoever, our club's going to be punished. And we might be docked points, or we might have to miss out on a competition, or whatever it may be. But the problem is, can the FA really go to UEFA, to FIFA now, and say, look, Montenegro have to be punished heavily? There's an instance, obviously, in the women's game in this country, you know, only a couple of weeks ago, where a player was found guilty of racially abusing another player. It was a 5-game ban and a £200 fine. £200.
Yeah, it's not much of a message, is it?
Well, it's just a nonsense. You know, how, you know, 5 games and a £200 fine is ridiculous. I don't care how much you're earning. That doesn't hurt you. You know, if you're a professional footballer in League Two, in the women's game, or in the Premier League. So surely we've got to look at that ourselves first as an FA and say, right, OK, eradicate it. Make the punishment seriously harsh, because we don't want it anymore. But until the punishment fits the crime, and it is, it's like anything in life, it has to be a deterrent. If there's no deterrent there, then people, idiots, mindless idiots, are still going to, you know, do this from time to time.
Yeah, exactly. We, of course, return to the Premier League this weekend as well, and this title race is starting to really hot up, Danny. I know probably your Man City heart will be dragging the title to Manchester if you can. Do you think Liverpool have got a chance of stopping them this year?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult. I think Manchester City now sort of are the favourites. You know, they are going for it. It's interesting. I speak to obviously a lot of football fans on my travels, and even Manchester United fans. And they're thinking, oh, you know, the worst thing could be would be a Manchester City Liverpool Champions League final, where City are going for the quadruple, and if not, Liverpool win the Champions League. You know, it could be tough times for Manchester United.
Yes,
but no, I think City's quality is superb. Strength in depth is absolutely amazing. When people say fighting on all four fronts is difficult, yes, it is. But equally, at this stage of the season, they're not going to get any fitter, so they don't have to train. They know how they're going to play. They have strength in depth, and they have that experience of when the pressure's on, they know how to win football matches. And I think City will win. I think City will win the league. Whether they win the Champions League is going to still be very, very difficult. But equally, if you're Manchester City, if you won the FA Cup and then you also won the League Cup, which they've already won, and nothing else, would that be considered success or would it be failure? I think to win two trophies, it would still be a slight failure if they don't win the league or the Champions League, which sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it just sounds mad when you consider where City were, what, 15 years ago. Just conversely, you know, it's all very well saying City are brilliant. Will Liverpool feel there's anything they could have done differently? Obviously, win games, don't draw them, but can you highlight any...
Not throw away a 9-point lead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That would have helped.
But how, I mean, why did it happen? Can you put your finger on it?
Well, sometimes it is pressure. You know, so, and it's like any top sport, so much of it is psychological. The people, they haven't bottled it. That's not true. But sometimes when you haven't been in that situation before, you're trying so hard. You're so desperate. It's like playing golf. You know, if you're focused and relaxed, you hit a good shot. If you try and hit it a little bit too hard or you force it, you end up skewing it or it comes off the toe or whatever and you shank your shot. And that's no different from football. You know, when you try too hard, you force it, sometimes it doesn't quite happen. And it's having that experience under pressure to be composed at the right time, to have that incredible mix of focus, you know, the right amount of adrenaline flowing. But when the moments come, having a cool head, you know, and being able to make the right decision.
Danny, always a pleasure to listen to you, a man with a cool head under pressure in all circumstances, golf course or otherwise, I'm sure. That's Danny Mills there, ex-Manchester City and England fullback, backing City for the title, I'm afraid to say, which, as a Liverpool fan, means he might be in a little bit of trouble with me, but I'm sure we'll have him back when Liverpool romped to a Premier League and Champions League double. Love Sport. We're, of course, celebrating that marvellous victory by England in Montenegro last night. 5-1, 10 goals in 4 days. Brilliant stuff from the young lads, honestly. Gareth Southgate's got them playing so well. But unfortunately, that wasn't the only thing we were talking about last night and this morning. And I think that we will talk much longer about the treatment that players were given than the performance that they produced. Let's hear what Luther Blissett had to say about those terrible chants last night.
I don't think you shut the stadium. I think what UEFA, these gutless idiots who run football, and it's the same with FIFA, what you do with these people now, and it is so obvious it's gone on, and they had people there, and if they don't now go ahead and put a report about it, Montenegro should get thrown out of the competition tomorrow. today should be done straight away. They should just get slung out of the competition now and get banned for the next 5 years for ever playing in any international competition. All of them. And I tell you, if you did that, they would very quickly come round to doing something about it in their own country, because that's where it's got to start. They've got to do something about it. We can shout and scream and holler as much as we like, but it's got to start in their own backyard to sort it out. Like, they had to face that here in England, and you know, we've gone an awful long way to clear it. Yes, we've still got ways to go, but at least we are addressing the problem, and we do recognise there is a problem. These countries and UEFA, and they don't see a problem. I mean, FIFA, on the Sepp Blatter, what was it, 3 years ago, decided after an investigation of what, just over 18 months worth, decided they had solved the racist problem. There was no longer a problem. They're idiots, these people. All they think about is money, and they don't think about the human cost to everything that they do.
That's Luther Blissett there talking on Ian Stone's breakfast show this morning. Now, it's hard to disagree with Luther. Remember that he was the first black man to score for England. He speaks for a lot of people when he speaks, and you can hear the passion in his voice, because that racism that we saw last night, monkey noises being chanted from the crowd at the black players, repeatedly, by the way, it's like something from the 1980s when Luther was in his playing days, and he had to contend with a lot of that. He, of course, played in the UK. He also played over in Italy, and it wasn't easy for him. The saddest thing about it last night, though, it was so eminently predictable. I actually said it on yesterday's show that Southgate would have to take under consideration when picking his team that racism would almost certainly come into play. Callum Hudson-Odoi had never started a top-level game of football. All right, had in the Europa League, and maybe you could say that Montenegro are a Europa League team, but he'd never started in the Premier League. He'd never started for England either. So we all feared that he would face racist abuse, and frankly, it just seemed inevitable that it would come to pass, and so it did. It's to his, to Danny Rose's, and to Raheem Sterling's eternal credit that they stood up and were counted in an England shirt last night. It would have been very easy, forgivable, and completely understandable had one of them gone to Southgate after 65 minutes and said, "Look, boss, we've won the game. I'm getting treated terribly by these animals. Can I just disappear down the tunnel? Honestly, can I just go?" Honestly, that's what I probably would have done. I don't know if I would have been able to cope in the same way that those three young lads did. In fact, I know I wouldn't have been able to cope. I would have just said, "Look, I don't want to stop the game because it's embarrassing and I don't want to disadvantage my teammates, but I just can't cope with it on a personal level. I'm just going to go." The kind of tragic thing is that no one did, because they're used to it. Because they're actually hardened to the reality of an unequal society in which racism is absolutely rife. And why? Because of the footballing authorities. Because those footballing authorities have failed to protect the players who play the game, that make them the money, that represent them on the pitch. There are protocols which allow the referee to warn the crowd about racist chanting over the PA system, and after a warning, then abandon the game. But what referee, really, what referee in his or her right mind is going to go up to a group of hooligans and say, "Now then, chaps, this really isn't on"? It's not going to happen, because they're not empowered by UEFA. They're not backed by UEFA or FIFA or the FA. Instead, the sanctions that UEFA now produce have to be unequivocal. There should be, and Luther said it, and I find it very hard to disagree with him, there should be an instant disqualification from Euro 2020. That's the kind of message that they need to send. One that says this kind of behaviour is completely unacceptable within our competitions. Because just saying that isn't enough. You have to actually say it with the actions that you produce. Expel Montenegro from the competition. Playing in the Euros isn't a human right, by the way. It's a privilege. Many countries have fought hard. Say Kosovo, a few hundred miles up the road, have fought very hard for the right to be afforded that privilege to play in the Euros. So you take that away from Montenegro and see what happens. From there, you can start working out on rooting racism out of football. You can't take it out of society in these countries necessarily, even in this country. It's not your responsibility, it'd be very hard to, but you can root it out of football. You send an education task force, you part fund it from UEFA, part from the Montenegrin FA, and you deal with these Neanderthals who think it's okay to buy a ticket to a football match and chant at someone because of the colour of their skin. It's the only way to do it. Strong, uncompromising punishment, and then education. Because if you just use the latter, and I can understand why people might, it sort of looks like you're failing to deal with the problem, that you're not actually got any deterrent for the problem, that these fans can commit these crimes and get away with it. You couldn't do it on the street, by the way. You couldn't do it on a train. So why are you allowed to do it in a football stadium? The reaction of Sterling was pretty magical, though. Credit to him again. Celebrating his goal, pulling his ears, mimicking a monkey, and basically saying, why not? Bring it. And he tweeted after, he said, best way to silence the haters, and yeah, I mean racist, hashtag get some education. Sterling's just been made part of the leadership group in the England camp, alongside the likes of Dyer and Fabian Delph, and he said he would speak to Callum Hudson-Odoi and Danny Rose. Hudson-Odoi, by the way, spoke afterwards. Fabulous eloquence and maturity. Amazing to think he's 18. I don't think I had an ounce of that level of maturity when I was 18. Sadly, we didn't hear from Danny Rose afterwards. Not through any lack of maturity or eloquence. He received a late yellow card in the game and was subjected to another flurry of racist abuse and said he was apparently reportedly too upset to speak. I completely understand. He was asked to swap shirts with some of the Montenegro players and refused. He left his own England shirt crumpled on the floor of the dressing room. And that really gets to me, actually. It really sort of brings home what this is about. That England shirt is something that each and every one of those players has fought tooth and nail to earn the right to wear. Danny was made to feel ashamed of who he was last night by those Montenegro fans, and that is not fair. He stood up for his country, and now it's time for his country to stand up for him. The FA and the Premier League for too long have been too weak, too muddled and too confused about how to deal with racism. They must lead on this and make racism absolutely what it should be, a thing of the past.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.